Hey there, I'm Brittany, and welcome to the Cape Cod Church Podcast. If you'd like to learn more about us, you can visit our website at capecodchurch.com. In the meantime, we hope you enjoy this message in our current series.
I missed my cue. Man, I was into worship. Well, good morning. So we're kicking off a new series today. We're going to be in a couple of different places. If you want to get ahead, we're going to start over in Acts chapter 17. We're going to be a good bit in Acts today, maybe even through the series. Sometimes I was telling our volunteers this morning, we gather for prayer earlier this morning, and I was telling them sometimes it can feel like faith is a fight, like put on the gloves, man. It can just feel like, man, in particular, you may feel like following after Jesus in this world is like a, whoo, man, put on the gloves, fight it out. In fact, you may sort of be on the fence about faith. You may be like, where does Jesus fit in? And part of your reason might be you just don't want to get in the fight. You're like, man, can't we all just get along? As the famous Rodney King say, can't we just all get along? It's a famous bumper sticker. You see it all over the place. Coexist with all the religious symbols cleverly placed out to give the word. Coexist. Can't we all just get along? And it feels like the answer is no. We cannot. I mean, we are at each other, and it feels like, well, to hear people say it, it feels like it's worse than ever. But I'm an optimist. I'm not sure it's worse than ever. In fact, you go back to the founding of our country. Woo! Talk about religious wars. I mean, listen, our country was birthed when a bunch of people said, we can't handle it anymore, and they got on a boat and went to the wilderness. How many of you are getting on a boat and going to the wilderness? Man. A few years later, a guy named Roger Williams shows up in what's now Massachusetts with the Puritans, but he's got some new ideas. On the boat ride over, he had become convinced about baptism. He would launch what became known as the Baptist, but not in Massachusetts. No, no, no. You can't do that here. They kicked him out. Boom, you're gone. He went to Rhode Island. That's how Rhode Island got started. The first Baptist church in America, down in Rhode Island. Roger Williams. And he's got a park. I don't think he knows about the park. Man, we've been at it. We've been at it. When we got around to getting our first president, it was a no-brainer. George Washington, he's our guy. He led the battle. That guy could have been king for life. But he didn't. Famously, after two terms, he said, I'm done, I'm out. We don't need a king. You may remember, the next guy was John Adams. Good Massachusetts boy. The Puritans were back in charge. Listen, if you're from, I'm a born and bred Massachusettsian, whatever that is. We like being in charge. Of course, it didn't end quite that way. He was in a nip and tuck fight with Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson, the next time over, would win. And he became our third president. And Adams was not happy about it. And to read the history books, this was all because Jefferson was all about states' rights and Adams saw more of a role for the federal government. But an honest reading of it would tell you that underneath all that, there were deep-seated religious differences. Adams came from that long line of deeply spiritual, pietist, Puritan believers. strong convictions, building the city on a hill for God, influenced our country in incredible ways. Jefferson was not quite down with the Puritans. Jefferson was famously influenced by the French and Bonaparte and the rising atheism of France. In fact, Jefferson made his own Bible. He took out all the, I don't know, the good stuff. You know, like the resurrection. He's got a Bible, just left it with Jesus as a good moral teacher. Get rid of all that miracle resurrection stuff. You can see the feud was on. In fact, the feud was so hot that these two formerly friends, founding fathers of our country, didn't talk to one another for 12 years. Any of you got friends you haven't talked to in a few years? Whew, I bet so. Last couple years been seriously divided. 12 years. Till finally a friend in common got him to start writing letters back. And we have those letters, 185 of them. And a little thaw began to happen. Their convictions still deeply seated, debating them out. But a thaw, a little bit of friendship. And then they died. On the same day, the 4th of July, 50 years to the date after the signing of the Declaration of Independence, Adams, on his deathbed, bemoaned, "Jefferson survives. He outlasted me." Except it wasn't true. Jefferson had died hours before. My goodness. It's a fight. Put them up. And maybe it's because we haven't understood deeply what God is doing in the world and what he wants us to do. And that's what we're talking about in this series. And if you're here and maybe you're new to faith, or you're just exploring, or you're returning, or you're not sure. First off, I'm so glad you're here. One of the things I love about Cape Cod Church is the diversity of journeys, people at every stage on this life of discovery. But if that's you, if you're like returning to faith, exploring faith, unsure about faith, let me give you three questions to get you started in this series. Is it true? Do I want it to be true? And what would my life look like if this were my truth? You see, in some ways, we've all been wrestling with those questions, and I'll come back to them as we go along. And it's not just been for a few hundred years, it's been for a few thousand years. In fact, the New Testament tells us the story of how this unfolded. There's four biographies of Jesus, and then there's one biography of the early church. It's the book that we call Acts, and it just tells us how this all unfolded after the life of Jesus at the beginning of the church. Let me read to you one particular story. From Acts chapter 17, with Paul, in verse 16, it says, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, this is the famous city in Greece, he was deeply troubled by all the idols he saw everywhere in the city. If Rome was the center of power, Athens was the center of intellect, of thought, of debate, of philosophy. He went to the synagogue to reason with the Jews. First, let me go talk to my people, see what they're saying. and the God-fearing Gentiles. And he spoke daily in the public square to all who happened to be there. This was the process of the day. Just, hey, what's happening? And what's with all of these idols that you have? He also had a debate with some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. Jefferson claimed a bit of being an Epicurean. There it is. And the Stoic philosophers, the two opposite ends of the spectrum. When he told them about Jesus and the resurrection, they said, "What's this babbler trying to say with these strange ideas he's picked up?" Others said, "He seems to be preaching about foreign gods." So then they took him to the high council of the city. Come and tell us about this new teaching," they said. "You are saying some rather strange things, and we want to know what it's all about." It should be explained that all the Athenians, as well as the foreigners in Athens, seemed to spend all their time discussing the latest ideas. So Paul, standing before the council, this is on the Areopagus. It's just across from the Acropolis. It's called Mars Hill, is what we often refer to it as. And he says this. He addressed them as follows. He says, "Men of Athens, I notice that you are very religious in every way. For as I was walking along, I saw your many shrines, and one of your altars had this inscription on it, 'To an unknown God.' This God, whom you worship without knowing, is the one I am telling you about." So here's the interesting thing. Here's what Paul didn't say that we would sort of, in today's world, expect him to say. He didn't say they're all the same. Like, aren't they all? Listen, it's all just the same. Let me add in another one and put it into the mix. See, that's the cultural current today is they're all the same. In fact, we've got a couple of analogies we love to use in culture today, and it's our effort to sort of, can't we all get along? And out of can't we all get along and coexist is, aren't they all just the same after all? And this really wasn't a thing. And in fact, this ideal sort of gathered steam after World War II. We saw the horrors of the Holocaust. And we saw the deep-seated religious hatreds that were underneath all of that. And out of that, there was a movement to say that Judaism and Catholicism and Protestantism were all sort of the same. In fact, the analogy we use for this is they're all different paths up the same mountain. Oh, down in the lowlands, they start in all kinds of different places, but ultimately they get to the top to the same God. Stephen Prothero, who is a professor of religion at BU, but doesn't write from a Christian perspective, not at all, wrote a fascinating book called God Is Not One some years back, where he basically says, listen, you can say a lot of things about the religions of the world, but what you can't say is that they're all the same. They start out in different places, and frankly, they end up in quite different places. That's not being contrarian or ugly. It's not making a case for anger or fighting. It's just stating what is reality. Here's the other one we use. They tell the analogy of four blind men who come on an elephant. Ever heard this one? They said, you know, it's all the religions of the world are like blind men who come on an elephant. And one of them feels his great body and says, it's a wall. Another one feels the tail and says, ah, it's a rope. Another one feels the leg and says, it's a tree. I know it's a tree. Another one feels the trunk and says, oh, it's a snake. Fascinating analogy. But is it true? We know they don't all start out at the same place, but do they end up at the same place? Prothero does something I think is fascinating, and a few others, John Tyson, who I love to read, these two have made their own attempts and of saying, hey, here's how the religions of the world look at things, and here's how they fix things. So I thought for just a few minutes I just want to make the case, not for or against. I just want to make the case in words I think most of them would agree. For my part, religions, and not just religions, philosophies, worldviews, they all do the same thing. They look at the world and they say, here's what's wrong. And then they say, here's what's really wrong. You'll see it in a moment. That's how it works. Here's what's wrong, and here's what's really, really, really wrong. Here's what's behind the wrong, and here's how we fix it. Here's what's wrong, here's what's really wrong, and here's how we fix it. I'm going to put these on the screen behind me. Buddhism says suffering in the world is wrong. But then it says what's really wrong is desire, the things we want, and the way out of that is, well, it's nirvana, the eightfold path, among which are things like meditation and chanting as a way of bringing yourself to another place, a better place called nirvana. That's one way of looking at what's wrong in the world, what's really wrong, and how do we solve it. Hinduism looks at the world and says, what's wrong is the cycle of life and death. Literally, reincarnation. I'm always amazed when people talk about reincarnation as a good thing, because people who actually believe in reincarnation don't think it's a good thing. Hindus say, this is the problem with the world. We're stuck in this cycle of life and death, and life, and death. And the reason they say it's a problem is for something else we love to talk about, karma. Karma is consequence. And because of our karma, we're stuck in this cycle of life and death and life and death. So how do you solve it? Well, you solve it with moksha, or release. The goal is to be released from the cycle of reincarnation, of life and death. And among Hindus, there are different beliefs about when and if and how that happens. Confucianism says the problem is chaos. The real problem is moral character. And the answer? Humanity, education, ethics, ritual. You can see how this influences whole societies. Education, ethics, ritual. Islam says fear, but really behind it, the real problem, self-sufficiency. Rebellion, the way it's resolved, the five pillars. Confess Allah, daily prayer, charity, fasting, and pilgrimage. These are the five pillars that will lead you against self-sufficiency, solving the problem of fear in your life. They start out in different places, and frankly, they end up in very different places. And it's not just religions. We could go on and on, but here are some worldviews that will seem familiar. Marx, who gave us communism, looks at the world and said, oppression is the problem, the oppression of the masses. But what's really the problem? Capitalism. Money, ownership. What's the solution? A classless revolution. Less individualism, less ownership, giving us the gift of identity warfare. Freud comes along, and of course, Freud famously sees sex in everything. What's wrong? Neurosis. Mental dysfunction. What's behind it? Maladjustment. We're twisted from trauma from our youth. The answer? Psychoanalysts. Nietzsche, who in many ways gives us fascism, says the problem is control. Well, actually, the lack of control. And the reason we don't have control is because we're weak. And the answer is to accumulate power. Whole worlds have been built around this. But it's not just the philosophers of old who form political systems. How about the worldview that's so prevalent, but so sort of hard to pin down? Let's call it the worldview of pleasure. What's wrong? I'll tell you what's wrong. Rules. What's really wrong? Morality. Morality. What's the answer? Pursue pleasure. Hedonism. Here's one last one. Secularism. What's wrong with the world? Progress. We're not making enough progress. Secularism is maybe the one we're most familiar with because we see its effects everywhere. Coming through the middle of the 19th and late century, as scientific method took off and discoveries were being made by medicine and science at every turn, we were convinced this is the answer. Secularism would say, what's really wrong? I'll tell you what's really wrong. Religion is what's really wrong. A belief in God is what's holding us back. What's the solution? Science. Science is the solution to everything. And don't get me wrong, if you've been around here long, you know that I love and appreciate what science has given us. But in this sense, it's the idea that it can answer and solve everything. Except it can't. Wow. I said all that to say, is it any wonder we can't get along? My goodness, these are wildly different ways of looking at the world, from where we start to where we end up, what we think is the problem, and what is the solution. But it turns out they all do have something in common. They all think there's a problem. Nobody looks at the world and says, perfect. Keep doing it just the way you're doing it. They all agree there's a problem. And if you look closely, they all agree that you can fix it. Every one of them offers a prescription, some of them more detailed than the others, on what you can do to fix the world. Try harder, work harder, follow these five steps, do these three things, discover one more discovery. Here's the problem. You are the solution. And it turns out we sort of like that. There's something in the human spirit that just rises up and says, yes, we can do it. And we rally around charismatic leaders, world philosophies, as divergent and sometimes as damaging as can be, and we say, we can do it. We can make a better world. Yes, we can. What an incredible amount of pressure to think that all of the answers are right here. Of course, I left out Jesus. What does Jesus say? How does Jesus enter into this story? Where does he start? What does he say is wrong and what's really wrong? And what's the solution? Jesus looks at the world and he would say, well, we have a bunch of words to describe it, but let me just put this one up on the screen. He would say, we're lost. Would he say they're suffering? Yeah. Would he say the world is broken? Yes, but in a word, he would say we're lost. Or in another word, he would say we're dead. But what's really wrong, he says, is sin. Read it closely. It's unavoidable. What's wrong is we're lost, but what's really wrong is sin. And he's very clear about it. It's the sin around us. That's you and you and you and you and you and you. And in us. It's me. That's why finger pointing is so dangerous. He said, that's the problem. The problem is sin. Sin in the world, sin around us, and sin in us. And we're culpable. While sin is a force of evil in our world, we make choices, and so we partner with it to do things that are wrong. And Jesus says, that's the problem, the real problem. What's the solution? In one word, Jesus would say, the solution is grace. Grace. Stories told, C.S. Lewis, who was a famous writer, Oxford professor, who started out as something of an atheist, who then became notably a follower of Jesus and wrote for us some of the greatest works about that journey. Said that one day he happened in, I'm guessing on campus at Oxford, on a debate hall of comparative religions, where they were doing what we just went through, looking at all of these major religions and trying to find out what were the differences. And they came to a point where they were discussing what made Christianity different. And Lewis walks in, and somewhat of an epic figure on campus, and he says to the group that's debating, he says, what's all the fuss about? And he says, we're debating what makes Christianity unique. And Lewis says, oh, that's easy. Grace. And he walks out. He wasn't wrong. Grace is the great separator. Here's why. Grace reverses the equation. See, every worldview, philosophy, and religion that we've looked at says, this is the problem. It's out there. And here's the solution. It's right here. The problem is out there, and you are the solution. And Jesus comes along and he reverses it. And in some ways he goes, no, you, the problem is in you. And then famously he says, but the solution is not you. The solution is not you. You can't fix this on your own. What a fascinating way to flip the story on its head. The solution is not you. This turns out to be so incredibly difficult for us to grasp because we like fixing stuff. We like being in control. Do you like being in control? I love being in control. I don't like letting other people drive, hold the remote control, nothing. I love control. I like succeeding. I like fixing. And there's something about what you can do that resonates. In fact, this has been a challenge since the earliest days of Christianity. In fact, there's a story. I want to read it to you in just a moment. In the early days of the church, and they're just getting going, and they're trying to figure out how all of this works together. And in Jerusalem, many, if not most of the believers were Jewish, and they had come from Judaism, and they were trying to figure out how to follow after the way of Jesus and let go of this life of the law. This is, we saw so much of this in Romans. And how do I let go of this life of following the law, of keeping the law, of keeping the rules? And so they were kind of meshing them together. And there's this great gathering. Let me read to you a couple of verses in Acts chapter 15. There's this gathering where the Jewish believers are telling the Gentiles, okay, you can follow Jesus, but you're going to have to do some stuff. This is the way it works. We got some rules, some Jewish rules we want you to keep. The Gentiles are like, okay, what's that? Well, they said, circumcision. They were like, time out, deal breaker. Right? I mean, this was an issue. People was like, no. And so it becomes this whole, and Paul comes in and makes the case, and they're debating it, they're fighting it out. Let me read to you the answer, because it's beautiful. Peter stands up, and he says to all the people, he says, so why are you now challenging God by burdening the Gentile believers with a yoke that neither we nor our ancestors were able to bear? We believe that we are all saved the same way, by the undeserved grace of our Lord Jesus. I love what he says a few verses down in verse 19. He says, and so my judgment, Peter was the boss, my judgment is that we should not make it difficult for the Gentiles who are turning to God. They were fighting with that human nature that, like, well, there's got to be something I can do. There's got to be some rules, right? There's got to be, I mean, isn't there a little bit of earning this and me making it better? And they were just like, listen, do not pollute the grace of Jesus Christ. Because it turns out the grace of Jesus is powerful. Here's what it says in Romans chapter 6, just one verse, verse 14. Paul would say this about grace. He said, sin is no longer your master. For you no longer live under the requirements of the law. Instead, you live under the freedom of God's grace. I love that. The freedom of God's grace. There is something about grace that is transformative in our lives and in our world. Tim Keller is one of my favorite authors and probably a favorite for a lot of you too. We lost him a few years ago. What a great loss that was for us. He passed away much too young. My favorite book is not one of his most popular books. My favorite book is a book called Making Sense of God. I don't know why it's always resonated so with me, but in it, chapter by chapter, he outlines the incredible gift of grace and how it matches what our secular world is looking for. Another author put this list together. It's a summary, really, of the chapters of the book. This will just whet your appetite. Maybe you want to go back and read it. He said, here's what the grace of Jesus Christ does that's different, chapter by chapter. It gives us a meaning in life that suffering can't take away, but can even deepen. It gives us a satisfaction in life that isn't based on circumstances. A freedom that doesn't reduce community and relationships to thin transactions. An identity that isn't fragile or based on our performance or the exclusion of others. It gives us a way to deal with guilt and hurt through forgiving others without residual bitterness or shame. It's a basis for seeking justice that does not turn us into oppressors ourselves, the critical mistake of Marxism and communism. It gives us a way to face not only the future, but death itself with poise and peace. It gives us an explanation for the senses of transcendent beauty and love that we often experience. Wow. Grace is so powerful. And this is what Jesus offers. So here's my invitation to you this series. Whether you're brand new or you've been sitting in the seats for months or years, or whether you've been watching online and you're watching now thinking someday I'll visit or maybe not, and just exploring. Here's my invitation. Ask yourself these questions. Is it true? I mean, is it true about Jesus? Did he rise from the dead? Is he who he said he was? Is it true? But you may need to follow that up with another question even before you answer the first. Do I want it to be true? You see, do I want it to be true kind of pokes at another issue. It pokes at our values. Our values are how we see the world and how we want to see the world. It's what we love and what we think and what we want to be true, even if it's maybe not. And sometimes we just have to step back and ask ourselves, do I even want all of this about Jesus to be true? Does it conflict with my values? Which leads us to the third question. What would my life look like if this were my truth? Is there something missing in my life? When I read that long list, was there something that you just said, oh, I wish that were true? I want that. Is there something missing in your life that Jesus might be the answer to? Is it true? Do I want it to be true? And what would my life look like if this became my truth? Would you bow with me? Our heads are bowed and our eyes are closed. Man, I want to close a little bit differently today, just with a prayer for you. For the one who's maybe searching or questioning, or maybe looking to deepen their faith, their understanding. Their deeply held belief about what grace is and how it changes you. Maybe it was something in that long list that feels like it's missing from your life. Maybe Jesus is the answer. You can probably tell. I think he is. But that's your journey. And I'd like to pray for you in it. Father, you know every story in this room. You know the hurt that each person has gone through. You know the one who started off in church and left when they were scarred by it. You know the one who's been down the path and then back again and given up what feels like 100 times over. Or the one who, this is all brand new. And the story of Jesus is an outline and they're just beginning to fill it in. So Father, for each and every one, help us to encounter the grace of Jesus, to find the freedom in what God did for us through the gift of grace and grace alone. We pray this in Jesus' name.